down here.
Captain!
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Welcome to the greatest discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison. Adam, it's the moment we've been anticipating for a long time, looking at each other during as a normal matter of course for this podcast.
Yeah.
And many of the others we also work on.
How's that working out for you?
I guess we actually... technically, our the Max Fun Drive bonus episode that we recorded is the first one that we recorded with you as an Angelino.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was the one where you didn't stop at your new residence. You came straight to my place to record an episode of The Greatest Discovery.
That's right.
That only dozens of people will ever hear.
It's true. Yeah, you're kind of the Roderick of The Greatest Generation, because I'm driving to your place. My home is a total shambles.
Yeah.
It's all boxes and dust right now, and will be for quite some time. So this is going to be the arrangement that you're going to have to get used to.
But I think a good object lesson in why we rely on the listeners for support, right? Like, if this move had happened and this was just a diversion for us and not...
It's the first thing to go.
Yeah,
I think that's what you're saying. Yeah, absolutely.
We just filled our bellies with some barbecue and then came home and watched an episode of Star Trek Picard at my place.
The way it's meant to be seen.
This is pretty nice.
Yeah, this is all right. I could get used to that.
I could dig it.
Yeah.
I kind of wish we were drinking something, but I guess we could. I guess we could fire this one off sober.
I mean, don't threaten me with a... all right time.
If Rob edited drunk, I would be pissed, but I think we can record drunk. Drunk edit sober of podcasting, right?
You and I QA every episode that Rob edits and can't be sure that he's not drinking during the edit. So
with the number of notes we have to get... What do you think? Should we get a little tequila soda going here and get into the episode?
Yeah, I mean, this is not going to be a drunk episode. It's just two guys having an afternoon cocktail while talking about Star Trek Picard Season 1, Episode 7, Nepente.
This is one of those shows that's always got the last time on.
Right.
And I noticed they went in real close on some of the artwork, some of the XB Romulans were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of interlocking circles in that artwork.
Oh, really?
And I guess I just didn't notice it the first time, but that's definitely an image that the two red moons and the necklace seem to evoke.
Maybe they're just into making Venn diagrams. Like Borg, race of my species, and then in the middle, XB.
Yeah. When I went to college, there was we had a friend who'd never encountered the idea of a Venn diagram. Oh, cheers, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Here you go.
And
it's your booze.
That's true. You know, like there's like the regionalisms that probably are less and less of a thing because culture is so online now. It's more like subculture regionalism than actual physical regionalism.
Yeah.
But like, I'm young enough that like the stuff that they played on the radio where I grew up was actually pretty different from the stuff that they played on the radio where like my friends from New Jersey grew up.
Yeah. I mean, in Jersey, it's all Springsteen all the time, right?
It's Springsteen and Meatloaf.
Uh-huh.
There was another kid who... we were talking about Easter Island, the heads on Easter Island, and he's like, what? And
like, it feels like at a certain age, Easter Island and Venn diagrams were the only things I was interested in.
Right! And he was also from California, and he was like, oh, it must be some kind of an East Coast thing. And I was like, no, not an East Coast thing. See, general knowledge thing.
This is why good textbooks in public schools are so important. Before you know it, you get a generation of kids who don't know what Venn diagrams are,
yeah,
or what Easter Island is.
Yeah.
It's a tragedy.
Our buddy Manu Sadia has been trying to convince me to go to Easter Island with him.
Your buddy Manu Sadia is what I want to say.
What?
Keep that guy away from me.
He's like, the flights are going to be so cheap with COVID-19.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Manu Sadia, who relishes in the negative, I'm sure is loving the coronavirus scare that we're going through right now.
This episode starts with a flashback to the Daystrom Institute. We remember the beginning of this scene from, I think, episode 2 or 3 of this show. What they didn't show then and they show now is the non-consensual mind meld that Commodore O springs on Agnes Girardi.
She goes right in there with both hands.
I think that you have to ask with a little bit, you know, you have to give somebody a little bit more context when you when you go in for the mind meld. It's not, hey, can I show you what will happen? Fingers on face. It's like, can I show you what will happen using the ancient Vulcan technique of the mind meld?
It's, I mean, you would ask before touching anyone anywhere. And then there's an extra emphasis on the need to ask if you're going to touch their face.
Right.
And then finally,
if you're going to invade their mind.
I think it's crucial that you at least prepare them for the idea, but this is as traumatic as the mind meld we saw in the 6th Star Trek film.
It's the mind meld cross-faded with the Mission Impossible tape that will self-destruct, because it's like, your mission, should you choose to accept it, Dr. Agnes Girardi, person who works in a lab by herself all the time and is not a spy or a special agent, like, go into space and look into this thing for us. We get a glimpse of this mind melting truth.
It's basically a clip show Terminator 2. Like, it's the Judgment Day dream that Sarah Connor has.
Yeah. I think that there's going to be more about this in the next episode based on...
Right, because we see Commodore O wear the same black hood that we see a lot of Romulan characters wear in the preview to the next episode. And they're gathered around sort of a tiny Stonehenge, like a little patio-sized Stonehenge, maybe.
Techno Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Like any traumatic invasion of one's personal space, causes Agnes Girardi to barf her sushi up.
This is an episode where Agnes Girardi, I think, achieves the barfing hat trick.
A lot of barfing going on in this one.
She is barfing a lot.
Wow. She really is.
She's given a tracking device by Commodore O, and I think it is important to note that it's triangular, right?
Yeah, that seems very key.
The second most important thing about ingesting a tracking device is that it must be chewed in order to work.
She says she puts it in her hand and says, take this. And I didn't interpret that as eat this, but Agnes Girardi puts it right in her mouth.
Yeah.
And I wanted Commodore O to be like, no, I didn't mean like a pill. What are you doing?
I meant like put it in a belt loop or like stick it inside your bra, doctor. Like, what the hell are you doing?
You have to chew it.
Yeah.
This suspiciously triangular object.
Yeah. I mean, I think where before we might have had our suspicions about, oh, I think we're starting to, if we were to stick her into a column,
mm-hmm,
or like a grid where we put like good, good, bad, bad, good, bad, bad, good. Uh-huh. Like, I think she's skewing towards bad, bad, right?
This episode has me wondering because the next scene is Rizzo, like, knife to Hugh's throat, executing a bunch of XBs to try and get information out of him about where Picard and Soji went. She has really, like, villain monologued a lot so mm-hmm far, but in this scene, she's saying, like, by helping them, you have doomed trillions to their deaths.
Right.
And obviously, like, she and O are coded as super villainous, and seem like bad people who are willing to do anything
to do their bad thing.
To do their bad thing. But if their mission is saving trillions of lives, like, maybe they're not so bad. Like, I wonder if there will be a complicated outcome for them because of, like, what they're trying to do.
I've been thinking a lot about that this season, in that, like, part of what a TV show is trying to do is present you with bad guys and good guys and oppose them as the episodes go on. Is there a way to tell this story where we sort of understand both motivations?
Right.
And what does that do to the conflicts as we know them? Does that remove the conflict in a way that we just can't have if we're consuming episodic or theatrical programming? I wonder.
Yeah. It's also starting to worry me that this story could veer a little close to season two Disco.
Yeah.
And, you know, different creator working, like, in a different city. Like, Disco is made in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Picard is made in L.A. And you would think that the corporate overlords at CBS would be mindful of not having two seasons of prestige television that are telling stories that are too similar, but definitely seems to be at least dealing with a lot of the same themes at this point.
I agree. Yeah. Remains to be seen if the big reveal is going to be like the ones we got in both Discovery seasons.
Yeah. Definitely seems like the tracker that Commodore O gave Agnes Girardi is something that Narek has access to, right? Like, he can, he's picking up her thing, and that's why he's able to track the La Serena.
I wonder if by chewing and eating the tracker, it turns your poop black and, like, your mouth black. It's a real Pepto-Bismol tracker situation.
It's the gum in Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Right.
Would you care for some gum?
This scene where Rizzo executes all the XBs around Hugh is pretty traumatic in a scene and an episode that is traumatic for Hugh. This is a bad Hugh episode.
Yeah, a big Hugh episode. I feel like he gets a lot to do and a lot of, like, big emotional moments.
Yeah, Jonathan Del Arco is great in this episode. He really is.
Totally. Elnor does not get there in time to prevent this slaughter, which is not really the... Like, the slaughter is not the work of people who have the best interest of trillions in mind, I don't think. But maybe if they feel that desperate, like are they just like Jack Ryan, where they're like, well, we'll just do torture and we have to because that's the stakes are too high.
You're right. By not torturing them and just killing them, I think they're probably still the good guys.
Yeah, that's where I was headed with that.
The La Serena is being held outside by the Borg tractor beam and having their toilet carved out of their hull the way... I like to believe that all Borg tractor beams go for the bathroom.
Go for the bathroom first.
And then take that core sample out.
La Serena might be small enough that they only have one or two potties on board, and that could be a real problem.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you don't want to use the bathroom in Six Bay if you can help it.
No, especially with Raffi drinking as much as she is. She's probably taking real bad hangover poops.
Yeah.
It wasn't me.
The thing about Elnor being on the ship and the La Serena being held by the tractor beam is that if they were to escape, they need to figure out if Elnor's coming with.
Right. And he gets on the radio with them and declines to attend their escape party.
Yeah. It's the flashback that tells you and I as the viewers that the reason why they release the tractor beam and let them go, because with Girardi on board, they'll always be able to figure out where the La Serena is. And with Narek on board his little ship giving chase, it's not going to be a problem.
It's a very, did you install the tracking system in the Millennium Falcon question?
Right.
And I mean, I think Girardi's got a very interesting episode here, but...
I was sad that Elnor was being left behind, but when you see the rest of the episode, you understand that he needs to help tell Hugh's story.
Yeah.
Hugh can't be alone for the rest of this ep.
No, and I think that Elnor's drawn to lost causes, and And
he looks at that pile of XBs and Hugh nearby.
This cause is even loster than the one I was working on earlier.
Right. So the Venn diagram with lost cause in the middle is Hugh as one circle and pile of dead XBs as the other. Yeah.
I wish we had known one or two of those XBs. Like, I wish they'd like made one or two of those a character that we'd met.
Like maybe one of them was the one that recognized Lacutus.
Yeah. Just to give us a little bit more weight in that.
After the theme song, we find ourselves on Nepenthe, where Picard and Soji have taken the gate to.
Yeah. We meet Kestra, who is like a perfect, precocious Berkeley kid. Like, I definitely like really got the vibes of like the kids that grew up in special families in my neck of the woods off of her, and
yeah,
knowing that Michael Chabon spent a lot of time in Berkeley, this was a very familiar type of character to me.
I think you are this type of character, Ben. Is that what you're saying?
I think I in my childhood aspired to being this type of character, but I was mostly just an obnoxious idiot.
Mm. Kestra is a name of great significance in the TNG world. That, of course, is the name of Deanna Troi's dead sister.
Oh, shit.
The episode Dark Page where Loxana Troi had hid that dark secret about the daughter that she had that died at a young age, the secret daughter.
Yeah.
Her name was Kestra.
Wow. Damn. Did not pick up on that. That's a great pull.
The actor who plays Kestra Troi Riker in this episode is named Lulu Wilson, and she has a terrifically long IMDb.
No kidding.
Like, she is not very old.
And introducing is not the way she was credited in this episode.
Yeah.
She was bonkers. Great.
Yeah, I really liked her a lot.
She really, like, made a super three-dimensional character over the course of a single episode. Like, I want to see the Kestra show.
Really strong work by her. Strong work by her character in that she shoots both Soji and Picard in the head.
With, like, a homemade bow and arrow.
And then we go to credits.
I was surprised to see the season end where it did.
I mean, of all the things to take Picard out.
And, like, Picard, like, really trusted her. He told her the thing about his heart being made out of metal. And
he told her how to kill him.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, did you like the season?
Kestra does that thing that I think you were beginning to describe, the Berkeley kid thing of... She, on the one hand, we're doing Venn diagrams the whole episode.
It's kind of the Venn diagram season of television.
She is precocious kid. She is also super smart and inquisitive.
Yeah.
And in the middle of those two is Berkeley kid.
Yeah.
And it somehow gives her permission to be to ask probing questions in a way that an adult would never be allowed.
Yeah, probing questions, but she's also like emotionally engaged in a way where she like sees where she's like probed a little too deep and backs off quickly.
Right.
I really liked that about her. I thought that was like a tough line to ride, but they wrote it very well. One of the things that that she asks about is what is Soji's relationship to Picard, and this leads to like,
who is your daddy? And what does he do?
Picard pipes in with, I'm sure you've heard of Lieutenant Commander Data. And this is when Kestra drops the A-bomb, the android word.
Yeah.
I don't think Picard was hoping that bomb in particular was going to get dropped when and where it did.
When you're homeschooled, though, and you aren't around a lot of other people, you just blurt things out the way Kestra does here.
Totally. The blurting comes fast and furious because this is also when Soji finds out that Daj is no more.
Right. Yeah, kind of a lot dropped on her at once. but luckily they have arrived at a very safe space for Picard, for Soji, for Kestra, for you and me.
Yeah.
It is the loving arms of the Troy Riker house, the cabin in the woods.
Oh, my God. How bad do you want to spend a long weekend at the Troy Riker cabin in the woods?
Every weekend is how I want to spend it. This was one of a couple of times in the episode where I'm, like, really trying to hold it together.
Yeah.
Like, to see them is amazing. To see Troy is amazing. And I think we see a glimpse of Troy's character and power in a way that we so rarely ever saw. Like, even in the movies or in television, when she hugs Picard and like empathically senses all that he's been through and starts to lose it herself.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
You know, she's had that power forever, and now we're finally seeing it.
Yeah, like the interaction between them doesn't have that many words exchanged back and forth, but like you get all of the like loss that he's experienced, his diagnosis.
Yeah.
Like so much is done with so little in that moment. It was
Marina Sirtis is incredible in this episode, and this is just the start of what she does. Like, physically they're so close, but like the way she expresses herself physically with him
totally
is really great and powerful work by her. And Sir Patrick Stewart, to his credit, is like just as vulnerable in that scene. Like, for who else could he be as vulnerable? It's really great. It's a great scene.
You pointed out that her name wasn't in the opening credits at the beginning, but Frakes' was.
Yeah.
And that does feel like a bit of an insult to her, because I feel like she really carries a lot of weight in this episode.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not shading Jonathan Frakes at all by saying this, but I feel like Troy had more dialogue.
Yeah, I agree.
In the ep.
A lot of that stuff has to do with agents and executives hashing out things.
Which is why I think neither of us are thinking this is a veiled or otherwise insult at her.
I don't think it's that, but it does come across as a little tone deaf by the studio. Like, somebody up at the top should have been like, you know what? Like,
they should have seen it coming.
Like, from an optic standpoint, this is not good.
Yeah.
And we need to make sure that she's given a fair shake from that standpoint.
We so often in the season see Picard opposed to people who dislike him.
Yeah.
But we get a kind of a different version of that here, in that Picard is with people who are so strong and confident in themselves and in each other. And in contrast, you sort of see how defeated and alone Picard is by showing up on their doorstep. It's another version of that contrast. Picard and everyone else. Picard is so different from everyone he encounters, even people he's known for a long time.
I think that this was an easier pill to swallow.
Right.
But like, I don't think we need like any more illustration of the fact that he regrets the way he handled the end of the Romulan spacelift. But it was nice to get it in a way that didn't just feel like a gut punch.
Yeah.
Riker has a fully like Matt Howie level tricked out smart home.
Yeah.
When Picard walks in, he's like, "Yeah, you might want to like turn your security system on." And he's got shields and cloak scanning built into his rustic log cabin.
It had to be so fun to write his dialogue. Just hearing it in your head, you know exactly how he's going to bark it out to the sky.
Yeah.
It was a real thrill.
And I thought that they had just like given us a little taste of that with him telling Siri to shut the music when Picard first shows up, but then we get him raising shields.
Can you imagine having him as your dad?
Like, oh man.
Like, Kestra, dinner's over. Go to bed.
I don't want to have to say it a second time, Lieutenant.
we're on a four shift chore rotation around here.
I mean, you get a lot about that, right? Like, you get a lot of like Riker expressions when Kestra does something. Like, the camera will often cut to him just like beaming with the pride of a dad who really loves his daughter. And we also get this idea that Data and the adventures of TNG have sort of been the bedtime stories of this household.
Can't imagine. It's going to be so great.
Fuck. Right.
Has he told Kestra the story about the time that he de-evolved?
You know,
there was a time when your mother was a fish.
And her eyes have developed nictitating membranes.
Has he told her the story about the time he put that thing on and paraded around like one of them?
I don't believe this.
You know what? Speaking of wardrobe, you know they're not going to give us that kind of fan service, but to see inside Will Riker's closet would be amazing.
Yeah.
But also, Will Riker is keeping it very chill in his house pants and house robe.
Yeah, very like kimono inspired, a lot of deep Vs.
Yeah, it's the best. Yeah. Bringing the V back. To Will Riker, it never really left.
No. he's like, this never goes out of style, baby.
Yeah, I love it.
Never
I love
in fashion,
them.
But I'm always in style.
It's not totally joyful in the Troy Riker household. They have absorbed a great loss in a season that seems to be thematically related to the losses we feel in a lifetime. They've lost their son, Thaddeus Troy Riker, and everyone feels that grief every moment.
Yeah, it's the child's bedroom that hasn't been changed since the child passed.
The deep breath that Troy takes before going in.
Yeah, Soji and Kestra are in Kestra's room with the bunk beds, you know, going through what
Soji's... We need to be clear, we're talking about actual bunk beds and not like a shuttlecraft in her bedroom.
we've built ourselves a word prison. Yeah.
The L-Baz is inside Kestra's bedroom.
And they're, you know, having the conversation about, like, what's it like to realize that you're 3 years old and probably an android. And that's a real heavy trip for Soji. But also, like, I feel like Kestra's kind of a perfect person to, like, work through some of that stuff. Because
she's as curious as anyone else. And she doesn't have any
sort of... non-judgmental curiosity.
Totally.
But also, like, super in touch with, like, what it must feel like.
She's also... very similar to Soji in that when you're a child, you don't know what the truth is except for what your parents tell you it is.
Right.
And so, like, Soji has that same kind of relationship with the world around her if you compare that to being programmed.
Right. And she's also capable of meting out death on a huge scale the way Soji is, because she is killing these jackalopes that run around on this planet.
Yeah.
With reckless abandon so that her dad can make them into sausage.
I love this. I mean, not only is their cabin in the woods, you know, beautiful, it looks like it's got a sunroom.
Yeah.
And an upper level, it's got room for shuttlecraft parking. But he's doing a little cured meat situation there.
Yeah,
and he's got an outdoor pizza oven.
Everything,
are you kidding me?
Artisanal, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing's too good for Will Riker.
Eternity never looked so lovely.
This may be like the one departure for a Berkeley kid, as she would probably be like a vegan.
Oh, right.
if she was one of the children that I grew up around.
Yeah, you get the sense that the jackalopes are pretty dangerous. They've got venom sacs.
Yeah.
And if you eat them the wrong way, you get pretty sick.
Yeah, you get Agnes Girardi levels of sick.
Back on the La Serena, Rios has slowed his ship down in such a way that he's thinking he's just being followed. At this point, he doesn't know he's being tracked.
Yeah.
So he's like, well, if we're on the same course and he's following from behind, I'm just going to shut her down and let him zoom by. And by the time he figures out that we're not in front of him anymore, we're going to be free and clear.
It's the Top Gun trick, kind of. They've got the number of this ship. It's the head of the snake,
mm-hmm.
and it's very well armed, so they're not going to try and pick a fight with it.
Yeah.
I thought that these shots were a little strange because it would show both ships. You know, there would be like an exterior establishing of both ships, and they'd be like, it's just inside of our, or it's just outside of our scanning range. Like, it looked really close. It looked like you could like yell from the one to the other.
Their scanning range is how far they can hold an arm out a window.
Yeah, like what the, does the La Serena have terrible sensors?
I don't know. Probably.
I just feel like it was like maybe the visuals were like a little bit misaligned with what they shot with the actors.
Jurati isn't acting the same as she was in the beginning, and this is something that Rafi has begun to notice about her.
Rafi really like reads her. She sees that Jurati is trying to bail, but Rafi's read is basically just that she's kind of lost her appetite for the space adventure and wants to go home and feel safe now. She doesn't pick up on the layer underneath what is motivating Jurati. And I really liked how Jurati kind of turned up the anger. Like you could see it wash over her face. Like, oh, I'm going to try getting angry and like stamping my feet and saying, I want to go home.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't want to be a party to what's going on anymore. Like she's being eaten inside. And it seemed like she's still pretty committed to whatever Commodore O convinced her was going to happen, but she doesn't want to be involved in it anymore.
I think it's really interesting to see all the different seasons of Rafi's addiction, because, you know, when she was trying to kick the snake weed, you got a version of her. When she was in full-on addict mode, you saw a version of her that was also like very self-obsessed with her own deal.
Yeah.
She seems to be a functional addict right now at this moment in time in the show, because she is showing empathy and interest in other people.
Right.
She seems to have found, like, right or wrong, like the right balance of things to where she can work professionally and personally with this crew while still smoking that dank snake weed, you know?
Yeah, she's like a Denver snake weed user at this point, you know.
You got to get that Denver snake weed.
Yeah.
That's the shit right there.
She's got a bit of, you know, an important profession, but she still loves to fucking cut loose when she gets off work.
Are we looking at an emergency here?
Back on Nepenthe, time is the fire in which we burn the pizza, Ben. And the one person we know can't abide a pizza oven. We get one of our favorite characters from Star Trek past, Kira Nerys, beams to the surface, blows up the pizza oven.
Just recklessly shoots it while they're standing right next to it.
And I don't know what this oven was filled with, but everyone's dead.
It blows big.
And then we go to credits again.
Did not see the season ending where it did.
I know. Anyway, I hope one day we can get outdoor pizza oven. I don't want to be a wealthy man. I just want that outdoor pizza oven money.
Yeah.
It seems like a good scene.
I mean, I think if you had, I feel like if you guys ever moved back to Seattle, you could probably do that in that backyard.
You can't do that in LA.
No. That's just, when I put the barbecue on in our little like back patio at our place.
Yeah.
Such as it is, I feel guilt because I watch the little sparks go up into the sky and I'm like, I could land on something.
The reason you have an outside kitchen like Will Riker does is so you can entertain. Mm-hmm. Because what do we know about having a dinner party? Everyone gathers in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You take that kitchen outside, all of a sudden Picard's out there, you're drinking some wine, you're catching up. We learned something in this scene, Ben, and that is Troy and Riker moved to this planet because the soil has regenerative powers.
Yeah.
Is this a pet cemetery situation with their dead son?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Did Ben. Jay Gordon talk them into moving here? Did he tell them that what their son needed was weird dirt?
Is this a radish pizza? Gross.
Speaking of reads, Riker reads Picard in this scene and fucking nails it.
I love how everyone is telling Picard his story back at him.
Yeah. Yeah. Picard has really stuck to his guns on, I don't want to involve you in this.
Yeah.
And Riker's like, well, so cloaking, probably Tal Shiar. She's probably Data's daughter because I saw the way she tilted her head. Am I getting close? It's kind of like the first episode of Star Trek The Next Generation when Riker comes aboard and watches the first half of the episode.
We get that a couple of times in this episode even, the recapitulation of the season.
Yeah.
And then Riker ends with a truth or fiction style end to his monologue.
Yeah.
It's great.
Over in the tomato patch, Soji and Troy have an interesting hang where Troy gives Soji one of these tomatoes, tells her to take a bite.
Really great tomato. That's what that looks like.
It did look like a perfect tomato. Like, you know, wonder how they source these, right? Because like if you walk into a average grocery store on an average day, the tomatoes are going to be not this color.
A tomato that red is going to be wrinkly in 5 minutes. Yeah. It will have just reached peak red ripeness.
Right. You could be like monitoring the stores for a week. Yeah. And it, like, that must be what they did, right? Like they're like, okay, this scene is a floater in the shooting schedule. We're just going to have a PA like sit at the Vons until they restock the tomatoes. And when they look great, that's when we shoot it.
I know we have had or will have opportunities to ask direct questions of people who work in production on this show and on Discovery, and I'm just going to burn one of those questions right now. Is that my camera?
Yeah.
All right. I'm addressing the people who work on Star Trek Picard right now. What is the deal with these tomatoes?
Wow.
I want to know the tomato backstory. If this means we never get to ask another question again directly, so be it.
Fine.
I think it's crucial.
Do you think Troy was planning this when she handed the tomato to Soji? Or do you think she spotted the teachable moment in the conversation? Because what's brought out here is Soji has never eaten non-replicated food. This is her first bite of quote-unquote real food. She immediately leaps to real is better, and then we see it wash over her that she may not, in fact, be biologically derived, or, you know, she might not be a real girl. And then Troy uses it to kind of like turn it into a little impromptu therapy session. Do you think that Troy like went over to the tomato patch and took one look at those tomatoes and was like, I've got a pretty cool idea here?
I mean, what's clear is that the technology that Counselor Troy has available to her as a counselor is such that, like, she can turn a tomato into a teachable moment anytime she wants to, whether or not there's a tomato there or anything else. I guess the significance of that, of the scene, wasn't as profound to me. I guess I kind of assumed that a lot of people in Starfleet would have maybe only ever had replicated food, and that might not be that unusual.
Yeah.
But the story she's trying to tell with it still stands.
This conversation turns to the issue of trust, and Soji doesn't feel like she can trust anything. Like, she's been making little remarks the entire time about, like, you're playing mind games with me, and you know, just keep it going with the deceptions. She really does not have the thing that Daj had of a innate sense that Picard was a person that she could be safe around. And right. I wondered if that's because she's the one that got sent to the cube. She didn't get that programming.
Yeah.
She got different programming.
You are the destroyer!
That makes sense. That's some good canon. Some good headcanon.
Yeah, just a little dab of headcanon for the episode. Wouldn't be an episode of The Greatest Discovery without it.
Picard, dinner's ready, but Picard doesn't say that when he approaches. Picard sarcastically teases her about her reality being a lie. It's bad timing, Jean-Luc.
Read the room, Jean-Luc.
Yeah.
Troy is not a potted plant in this episode, but one thing that she was often used for in her potted plant days on TNG was to remind people to empathize and treat each other like full humans.
Yeah.
And she definitely has to do that again in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the case that she makes is, why wouldn't she be paranoid about her reality? That's really pressing a bruise, JL.
Yeah. Back on the cube, Hugh is ripshit about this whole situation, and has resolved to do something back in the queen cell to remove the Romulans from the station entirely. He's apparently got, there's something in there that he can do to cause that to happen. And Elnor is walking with him as he talks out this plan, and
you can't say it out loud, guys. Come on.
The classic Star Trek slip up where you walk into a room and you don't realize that somebody's right around a corner listening, and Rizzo walks out of the smoke with,
"We know the Borg ship is an open floor plan."
"We've put beams in this part of the ceiling and this part of the ceiling to hold up the load of the upper sections of the Borg cube.
If your conversations require privacy, we suggest one of the many privacy and breastfeeding rooms."
Yeah, so this turns into Elnor, you know, protecting Hugh and running around cutting Jat Vash killers down.
It's a fun nod to Indiana Jones here, I thought. Like, Elnor with his sword and Rizzo with the gun.
Yeah.
Rizzo just tries to shoot him.
Yeah. And then she's like, suggests more of a fair fight, an even footing fight where they put their respective weapons away. He sheaths his sword. She cat baskets her dustbuster.
If this is your first episode of any of our shows, and that was the moment you decided to start listening, you are not having a stroke. She does cat basket that dustbuster bin.
Yeah, they've gone to an invisible cat basket,
right?
A cloaked cat basket here in this future.
She's got Romulan throwing stars.
Yeah, she does not really keep up her end of the bargain here. And she throws one of these into Hugh's neck. Unfortunately, she's beamed out before Elnor can dispatch her. And I thought that this transporter beam looked like the Federation style of transporter beam.
Uh-oh.
Because we've only seen Federation style transporter beams in this series, but I think one thing that is pretty well established in Star Trek canon is that different species transporter technology looks and sounds a little different.
It's true.
So I'm guessing that this is Commodore O coming to pick her up or something.
Fucking O.
Fucking O.
RSVP Hugh.
Yeah.
Do you think he's really dead?
I think so.
That makes me really sad.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Delarco gets a great deathbed scene here. I think it's so important to note that you see his Borg half of his face in profile when he's talking toward the end of his life.
Yeah.
And expressing his feelings. Like, I really like that choice.
Yeah.
For blocking this moment.
Right. Yeah. It seems like it wouldn't work and wouldn't be as true to character.
Yeah.
If they've flipped the scene around and had him die facing the other direction.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a weird point to work backwards from, but I guess that's what you have to do.
I'm obviously very sad about this, and I'm just wondering how upset I will eventually be at that character being taken off the board.
Yeah.
Like, I know that's the exchange, right? If you want to feel something deeply on a TV show, you gotta break some fucking hues from time to time.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm grateful for Hugh's service as a character and that we got to hang out with him a few more times. But, like, that's the cost, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, that's how it goes.
You know, one thing I like to do when I'm feeling sad is eat a big sweet treat. And that's the tack Rafi takes with Agnes Girardi. She replicates an oops all frosting cake.
Girardi's not against replicated food.
Yeah.
Can you make yourself feel less full off of replicated food the way that you can turn off the effects of synthahol?
Oh, interesting.
That would be nice.
That would be cool.
I bet if you could, people would just eat and eat and eat, though. That would be bad.
Could they make food that's, like, less dense? Like, you feel like you're eating something, but, like, there's less matter in it?
I don't know.
Who knows? One thing that I felt like there was a bit of a continuity issue with the fact that the cake was clearly like 90% frosting, but then when she barfed, it was all cake color.
Yeah. When Rios is freaked out seeing red coming out of her.
Yeah.
Rafi mentions that that's the red velvet cake that she had moments previous.
Do you think that they were like getting ready to shoot that scene and the props department showed up with the piece of cake and they're like, what the fuck is this? And they're like, this is like the best looking piece of cake we've ever seen. And they're like, fine, yes, except for she's supposed to throw up later and he's supposed to say, oh my God, is she barfing blood? Guys, what the hell? What are you doing to us?
Allison Pill at this moment sees the hat trick coming.
Yeah.
This is the second vomit scene.
Yeah.
I think the third is in range, and I think if you're an actor, you've got to be excited at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very few people go for the vomit hat trick
in one episode, man.
Rafi's counsel here is a lot like Deanna Troi's, isn't it? And what my film paper is about is about their two ways of caring for people who need it, but they both use food, right?
Yeah, and chocolate specifically.
Yeah.
But yes, I agree, Adam. It's really eating her inside. She barfs, and Rafi has to run because their Romulan tail is back on them.
Was this the first time you really got a sense of the geography of the ship? Because it was for me. Like, we're using the ladder a whole lot. We're seeing foreground, background, like from within six bay, we're seeing the bridge. From up in the bridge, we're seeing down the six bay. Like, I feel
it's
like
a big empty space.
I feel like it took a long time for me to really grok the space.
Yeah. No, I felt the same way. Back on Nepenthe, they are finally sitting down to dinner, and the suggestion has been made to Picard, use our dinner table like the conference table and the observation lounge on the Enterprise. And I really liked that the center of the table was lit up. It's like, it's not an underlit piece of translucent plastic. It's
right.
A long row of candles because rustic.
Yeah.
But it's a very similar table.
It's great.
And they're sitting around it. And this is a scene where Picard kind of breaks it to them where he's at. He says, like, listen, if this guy Rios doesn't show up and pick us up, like,
we're going to need a backup captain.
I'm kind of out of cards here, and I'm going to need to figure out another spaceship. Is there a wretched hive of scum and villainy anywhere on this planet? There's like, well, there's a couple, but we think your guy's going to show up. And then they turn to the issue of whether or not Soji should trust Picard.
Right.
And it's a big scene. I think it's big and really well done.
I love how Soji approaches whether or not Picard can be trusted or whether or not he's telling the truth, because she approaches him from the same perspective as a lie detector test. Like, if you believe that you are telling the truth, you will pass a lie detector test.
Right.
And what Soji tells Picard to his face is, like, you believe yourself to be trustworthy, but I don't have any reason to believe the same.
Right.
I also, like, this scene, they're throwing around this Captain Rupert character's name and talking about how great he
Can't
is.
Can't wait to meet this guy.
Really want to know all about Captain Rupert. Also, I would have really loved a cutaway to Picard, like taking just a little bit of umbrage with the idea that anyone could be as good as him as captain, because clearly Kestra really loves the guy.
Yeah.
And he's sort of like Uncle Rupert in a way that is beloved.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder to what extent Picard was allowed or disallowed from being a little bit jealous about all this Rupert talk. You know, I'm a pretty good captain too.
Best captain ever, right?
Yeah.
A little weird to have a line like that in a show that you executive produce.
Yeah. Right? I thought so, too.
It's like the most false modesty to be like, oh, who said that about me? Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah. The Troy Riker household does not have a devices at the dinner table rule because Kestra has been under the table.
Yeah.
Sending messages to Captain Rupert.
Yeah.
And what she's found is the location of Soji's planet based on her brief description of it at the dinner table.
Yeah. She has all of the same information that the ROMs do, but apparently that's enough. I mean, you know, you look up in the sky on this planet and sometimes you see the moon and sometimes you don't. But if you see two moons and lightning on this one planet. Apparently that is enough to narrow it down.
Yeah. You look up in the sky anytime on Nepenthe and you're seeing the entire fruit bowl up there. You can see it all.
Woo, baby. The scene ends with a little moment of Picard basically saying, like, I was waiting to die before, but now I have a mission, Soji, and you don't have to trust me, but I'm going to do this mission, and nobody can stop me when I'm doing a mission. And I was like, yes, Captain Picard can't be stopped.
Right, right. This is a marshalling of his, like, mental resources and his confidence in a way that we haven't seen the whole season.
Yeah, yeah. He was kind of following instinct before, but now he's kind of said it out loud.
Right.
In a really cool way.
Back in Six Bay, Rios confides in Jurati that he thinks they have a mole, or, like, someone's being tracked, and that person he suspects is Rafi.
Yeah. I kind of wondered if he was saying he suspected Rafi because he actually suspected Jurati and he wanted to see if he could draw her out. But
that would be a smart guy thing to do.
That would be a smart guy thing to do, but it's not that. He definitely suspects Rafi.
I think it's great that Jurati says that it's her without saying it's her. She just disputes that it's Rafi.
Right.
Because almost immediately, Rios is called back to the bridge.
And is, like, giving Rafi major side eye from his captain's seat.
When Jurati's left alone, she's left alone with a replicator. And in that time she's given, she makes a hypo spray of neuranium hydride. This is something the replicator cautions her about ingesting.
Yeah, depending on species, this could be bad.
I feel like it could say that after replicating anything. Like, it replicates a hammer, and it's like, careful. Hammers are bad for skulls.
If I had a neuranium hydride, I'd hydrate in the morning.
And this is it, Ben. This is the moment. Where Jurati goes for the hat trick.
Yeah.
She hypo sprays her neck.
So she had her first barf was sushi. Yeah. Her second barf
red
velvet cake. Her third barf, foam.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a seagull who's been fed an Alka-Seltzer. She lets the foam fly.
Yeah. And the EMH pops into existence and we see it kind of like through the distorted final glimpses as she slips under.
Yeah. Back on Narek's ship, we see the effect of the hypo spray. By hypo spraying herself, Jurati has turned off the tracker.
Yeah.
And Narek does that thing where he, like, punches the steering wheel of his car. Because his nav doesn't work. He's very pissed.
It's interesting. I wonder how this thing works. Like, it's not battery powered. It seems to be, like, biologically powered.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She must have known something about it as a physician, because she's not dead. She hasn't killed herself.
The thing about Jurati after consuming the tracker is that she could never go eat at one of those restaurants where there are a bunch of, like, molecular gastronomy foams because the foam is the thing that dissolves the tracker, right? So every time Rafi's like, you know, maybe we should go to, like, a Grant Eschatz restaurant or something.
No, like, no 11 Madison Park, no Mugaritz.
Look, those places sound great and everything.
No Arzak.
Yeah. How come Jurati never wants to eat anywhere cool? It's too bad.
She's like 2 stars and under. She's never going for a 3-star, ever.
Yeah. The EMH tells Rios that Jurati has fallen into a coma, or if you're jaunty about it, a foma.
The kids will always talk about having FOMA these days.
Yeah.
Fear of missing Agnes.
All right. Yeah. You saved that one.
Took it in a surprising direction. Humor. on the artifact, Elnor is now a one-man band, and he is...
He's like a deli slicer with the guard taken off.
Yeah. He's like... This is the first person action video game based on Star Trek Picard, right? Elnor on the artifact.
Just doing combination moves with his swords.
Level by level, dispatching Tal Shiar, Jat Vash.
Yeah.
Maybe some unrecovered Borgs in one level. You know?
Hit L1 and R1 at the same time to hide under this Borg desk.
Yeah. He slips under this Borg desk, and what does he find under there?
He finds the Fenris Ranger beacon.
Yeah.
And you know he's going to hit that thing.
How did the fucking get left there?
I don't know, man.
They should have established it getting left there.
Yeah.
If they did, I missed it.
I mean, Picard didn't leave it behind in the Queen's room, right?
No.
Was that a Picard leave behind?
No, it was on this desk. It was like hanging off the edge of this desk.
I mean, the only other time we've ever seen one of those was the one that Seven gives Picard.
Does Picard still have his?
Here's the thing. When you work in this area of space, maybe everyone has the Fenris Rangers button.
Well, everybody that's seen the late night infomercial, help, I'm falling and I can't get up. Fenris Rangers, come rescue me.
Those commercials are so sad. Have you seen one lately?
I
feel like when we were growing up, the commercials were laughable, and now it's like, grandma's going to suffer at the bottom of the staircase. And the thing about being at the bottom of a staircase for 2 weeks is that you die slow.
Yeah.
Real slow. That's a level of detail we never got in the 90s.
Yeah, I don't think so. It was mostly just about how
robots are everywhere, and they eat old people's medicine for fuel.
I think this is a good sign for potentially getting a 7 of 9 back on the scene, which I love.
Yeah, I think Seven and Elnor joining up to kill a ton of Romulans is probably...
The body count on this season is about to go way up.
Yeah. It's about to be bonkers.
Yeah.
So anyways, Rios is able to ditch the head of the snake and is on his way to Nepenthe. And we get some final moments with the Troy Riker family. A nice hang between Picard and Riker out on a little dock over a pond that's small enough that I don't think you would need to build a dock over it other than just to have a nice place to sit.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's really nice.
Do you age into touching your friends as much as Picard and Riker here? Because I can't see myself ever sitting on a bench and like putting my arm around you or anyone else.
I know. Well,
it's
nice. We grew up in a particular time. Like I heard a This American Life piece that talked to a bunch of people that went to Iraq during our invasion of it under George W. Bush. And one of them was like a lady that I can't remember what she did, but she was some kind of private contractor and she knew a bunch of like local people. And one of them was a guy who she would see like walking down the street with his best friend holding hands. And she was like, I told him, you can't do that. And it's just like in their culture, if you're two dudes and you're best buds, you hold hands because they didn't have the gay panic of the 80s and 90s.
Interesting.
But I think like our generation of men like definitely like grew up in an era where that implied something that was
Oh, I
want to
be clear. I am not gay panicked about it. I don't like touching people or being touched generally.
Well, I'm saying that's probably true of you, and I don't think that it's coming from a bad place in you, but I think that our culture puts a lot of that stuff on us that we're not aware of.
That's fair. That's fair.
I really liked the wrapping arms around each other. And
you get a lot of that until the end of the episode. That physical affection between all of them is so pronounced.
Yeah, that three-way hug is like
ugh,
one of the
stomach
most...
Stomach punch.
Yeah,
and
I
they
loved
like
it.
Kiss each other.
Mm-hmm. And Picard goes full tongue with Troy, which I was amazed to see. Like, I mean, I knew they were really close, but that's like, wow.
I always notice this, and so I'm going to call it out because I'm going to be fair. It's one thing you know about me when I talk about these Star Trek shows and about movies.
Harsh but fair.
Right. There is a drone shot here over the lake.
Yeah.
It's the establishing shot. We were flying over the water, but they make the edit after this little unintentional, what I think, this pan move by the drone.
Oh.
And you got to make the cut a second before that. Like,
yeah.
This is the giveaway to every drone shot in any TV show or movie is you can sell it so that you don't even think about it being a drone shot until something like that is left in.
Yeah.
And it's just a half a second of rotation, but right. It's an unnatural camera rotation that only looks like a drone had shot it.
Right.
And you got to cut before that.
It's not a guy with a camera on his shoulder shooting out the side of a helicopter.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my nit to pick here on that. In an otherwise really beautiful scene. Fuck. I want to be the third on that little bench, Ben.
Yeah. I want to get right between those two and not speak to either of them.
I mean, if that stomach punch wasn't enough, the scene that follows is Kestra telling Soji what everyone who loves Star Trek believes.
Yeah.
And that is, if you don't have a parent, or if your parents aren't doing it for you in the parental department, you've got Captain Picard, and he will be your parent instead.
Yeah.
All you have to do is choose that.
Yeah.
And even like saying the words is giving me chills. Like Kestra might as well be like turning to camera and saying that.
Yeah.
Like she's convincing Soji, but what she's doing is telling all of us that the truth that we've known for 25 years.
8-year-old Adam sitting cross-legged on the living room floor.
Yeah.
Like, needed to hear it in those specific terms.
And you follow that up with the three-way hug of Riker, Troy, and Picard at the end.
Yeah.
Like, give me a break. Like, I was just dying at the end of this. I loved it. I loved how it ended. And it made me wonder, like, when Soji and Picard beam away and we get, like, the territorial, like, the music swells and we see Riker and Troy together, like, there's a finality to the feeling of that scene that makes me wonder if that's it for those characters. It makes me happy because I feel like they're happy, but in a greedy way.
I think at least Riker is coming back.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing I noticed about this scene was when Soji gives Kestra her hug, you get a nice close-up of Soji's hands, and despite beating a hole in the floor of that room like 2 days ago, her manicure is perfect.
Yeah, that's something our wives would be very envious of, a lacquer that lasts that long.
Yeah. Fuck, these are gels and they're already going.
Yeah, we get a little TNG music sting. We see the fruit bowl up above in the sky above Nepenthe, and that's our episode, Ben.
Did you like the episode?
I was so looking forward to this one for the Frakes and Sirtis aspect of it. Like, I wanted to be with Troy and Riker again so badly.
Yeah.
And it felt so good to be with them again. I think to think of this episode is going to be to think about them. When I read interviews with them before this episode and before the season, what did you hear? You heard about how difficult it was for the actors to find their voices again after so long.
Yeah.
And I was so happy and surprised and relieved that clearly they did. This is Will Riker and this is Deanna Troi. And those are their voices and their mannerisms and how they talk and think about things. To whatever extent the actors had faced challenges in like finding that within themselves, I'm so happy that they did, and that their fear of not being able to find it didn't discourage them from trying. Because,
well said.
I think they did it. And it's the reason that makes the episode great to me.
Totally. I mean, I think it's that thing of they did a lot of hard work and in the end it comes off looking easy. It just feels like the characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, without those interviews, I don't think we ever would have known how difficult that was.
It's an episode where it feels like a lot happens and it's very like actiony, but also thinking about it, I'm thinking about tranquility, being safe, being, you know, being secluded.
Thinking about, you know, the different choices people make toward the end of their lives and in retirement. Like, Picard and Riker talk about Riker being on, what is it, detached service or whatever. Like, he could get called up. He could answer the call if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But he's chosen his cabin life in a way that suits him, the way that a similar life could never suit Picard.
Yeah. Do we know if Riker ever got that fourth Pip? Or did he just decide not to bother?
Well, I mean, he was assigned the Titan as a captain at the end of the last TNG movie, and that was that was going to be his story. Picard got a new XO.
They do say like they raised their kids on starships, and that was why Thaddeus was so interested in the idea of having a homeworld.
The Titan was a story that was only told in books, but it was only just referred to at the end of the last TNG movie.
Weird that they gave Riker a ship that had the same name he'd given his dong.
Well, I mean, his ship isn't called Uncut Titan. So that's only half true.
The Hooded Titan. Do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages?
Yeah, got to do that.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first Priority One message is for Daniels. And it is from Future Daniels. Fixing the timeline in 350 characters or less. The message goes like this. Say no to the massage therapist. Those extra services include a chest hickey and a weird rash that you can't explain away. If I've got this P1 right, it should hit season one of TGG and your life won't spiral into the abyss.
Oh no, Daniels!
Oh, I've got spare characters. In my dark future, timeline Trump beats Clinton, but you can stop it. All you have to do is...
Oh no!
And that's where it cuts off. Future Daniels, kind of a fuck-up.
Yeah, sending the message to the wrong show and the wrong season.
Yeah. I don't believe in Future Daniels' ability to solve our world's problems.
I mean, I'm hoping Future Daniels works some of those kinks out, though. He tries again.
Kinks at the massage table, you mean? I just mean sore muscles, Ben.
Our next P1 is from Astrid, and it's for Matt. It goes like this. Hi, kiddo. Like the Greatest Gen listeners heard, it's your first birthday. My favorite picture over the last year was of you, a few weeks old, with a disco command badge pinned to your pink swaddling blanket. I couldn't wait to share it, not just with our family and friends, but with all of the friends of DeSoto. They'll be your friends too. Wow! That's two P1s for one kiddo on two podcasts.
It's pretty great. I love the confidence of being born into the Greatest Gen family.
Yeah. I mean, I admire the amount of confidence Matt has in our ability to keep this thing going.
Yeah, into eventually not canceling ourselves with some bullshit.
Wow. Well, if you would like to send a message from the future or send a message to your daughter, you know what to do. Head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message. And we really appreciate it because... this is our gerb.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of TripleClick.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to... oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! I did. I'm giving it to Picard this episode.
I'm shocked by that.
And it is for the A-bomb getting dropped outside of his control. The look on his face when Kestra says the word android, and then again when she when it comes to Soji's attention that Daj is no longer Picard really like gives a take that is super funny, and I laughed both times I saw it.
I am shocked that your Edward Larkin isn't Riker, which mine has to be.
Yeah. Well, Picard would have gotten it if he didn't get it for that. He also gets it for when he picks up the bottle of wine that Riker has out there by the pizza oven and gives it the look down the nose at the label, like, what the fuck is this shit? You know I make this.
Yeah. Yeah, that was low-key shade, right?
I loved that.
Yeah.
So Riker is yours?
By not saying anything about the wine, he says a lot about the wine. Yeah, I mean, I think it's Riker barking Starship commands at his house.
Yeah.
Like, it could be just as simple as that for me.
Yeah, Riker's got his house wired up in the way a guy who's into trains sets up a model train in his basement.
Yeah.
Like, Riker's turned the log cabin into a starship.
It's great.
He's on an away mission to the outdoor pizza oven.
I love it so much. I love him so much. If this is it, thanks, Frakes, for coming back.
And thanks, Marina.
Yeah. Well, what episode are we going to be thankful for next week, Ben? This is breaking news.
Yeah.
Breaking news on our show. We have the titles of the last three episodes of Star Trek Picard. The eighth episode, which is next week, is called Broken Pieces.
Mm.
Episode 9 is called Et in Arcadia Ego, Part 1.
Lego, my Et in Arcadia Ego.
And Episode 10, the season finale, Et in Arcadia Ego, Part 2.
Wow.
But we see some things coming up next week, and I think those things are wearing hoods.
I think that, yeah, much like the Titan, the implication I got from the trailer for next week's episode...
On the Titan, to release the shuttlecraft, you have to pull back the shuttle bay door a little bit, and you got to make sure that door's clean.
Yeah, every time, soap and water, every time you take a shower. I got the sense that next week is when we're going to find what the mind-breaking secret is.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's some people learning it and...
And attempting to claw out their minds.
Yeah. Get this out of me.
Yeah.
And a lot of discussion of the hell that will start if this gets out.
What if season one of Star Trek Picard is canonical Event Horizon? Hell is only a
word. Kind of seems that way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Can't believe it. Episode 8, next week.
Fuck. Another bit of breaking news. I saw a post that Discovery has been renewed through season 5 at this point.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the confidence right now.
That's some fucking swagger.
Yeah. Into it.
Looking forward to all of that. And
yeah.
I think we will leave it with our buddy Robs from here.
Yeah, let's do it. Thanks, Robs.
Next week's the Max Fun Drive.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Benjamin Harrison and Adam Pranica. It's produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Friend of DeSoto and YouTube sensation Adam Ragusea. The Greatest Discovery is made possible by the support of our listeners like you. Make sure the show continues by going to MaximumFun.org/donate. If you'd like to discuss the show online, please use the hashtag GreatestDiscovery. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Thanks, we'll see you on the next episode of The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.